Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today joining us all the way from France is author John Goldenberg. He has just published his new novel, Onero, which is the first in a series that he considers hard science fiction. John Goldenberg is an American author living between the U.S., Luxembourg, and the south of France, alternately writing and consulting in conjunction with a luxury boutique hotel which he owns and operates on the Riviera. John studied music theory and composition at Lamar University. His undergraduate studies were at George Mason University in Virginia, and his graduate studies at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. John has lived and worked in over 40 countries, writing everything from advertising copy to functional specifications, as well as science fiction, historical fiction, and general fiction. Arthur C. Clarke probably had the greatest influence on his work, and he includes Kurt Vonnegut and Douglas Adams as favorite authors. John actually visited Clarke at his home in Sri Lanka and acquainted Vonnegut in Reykjavik. I hope I'm getting that pronunciation right. His writing emphasizes hard science fiction against the backdrop of realism, mystery, and action, spiced with sprinklings of dark irony ranging through art, music, language, physics, cosmology, genetic biology, and even cuisine. And you can find out so much more about John at his website, john-goldenberg.com. So, interesting bio. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
Great. Well, I have to congratulate you on publishing Onero. This is actually book one in a series of four, I understand?
That's exactly right.
At least four so far. And then you have three other books in the works?
Yeah, I've got one completed, which is it's more historical fiction. It's called The Daughters of Pelas, about the Cold War. And I've got two others in the works that are general fiction and another historical fiction as well.
So, I mean, this is a lot of books on the go. What's really causing this creative push for you regarding writing at this point in your career?
I guess I've got the time. I'm laying back on the consulting a little bit, trying to minimize travel. And running the hotel probably, well, basically takes the mornings and evenings of my time, and I've got the rest of the day to work on the computer.
Oh, I see. You know, knowing that you are writing from the Riviera in your hotel, I mean, your life sounds idyllic. Is this the reality?
Actually, believe it or not, it is. We get fascinating guests, a beautiful place to live, gorgeous grounds, beautiful weather, although it's raining today, and all the fun of the Riviera. So it's pretty idyllic, yes.
Mm-hmm. So you're an American. It sounds like at this point, though, you're spending most of your time there in France?
I spend, probably half my time. I also spend some time in Luxembourg where I write, and then I go to the States primarily on consulting, but I carry the old computer with me wherever I go.
Oh, so you write on the computer. That's fantastic. You know, I just want to apologize to our audience. Both where you are and where I am, we're having some big weather happening today, and I know we're having a bit of a connection issue, so just wanted to apologize to our listeners today if we're having some crackling on the line, but I'm glad that we were able to connect anyway. So, John, you have actually lived and worked in over 40 countries. This is true?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
Believe me, it's a lot.
I can't believe. I mean, you must be just traveling like every few months. How have your travels made you a better writer?
Oh, well, certainly, I've met some interesting people, like as you mentioned, Arthur C. Clarke and Kurt Vonnegut.
Mm-hmm.
I've also seen some very interesting things as they relate primarily to history and the world itself. I've got a book coming up called Tuk Tuk about Sri Lanka, and I spent quite a lot of time in Sri Lanka. That's where I met Arthur C. Clarke, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And you do get a feeling for particularly countries that are, I guess you'd call them third world countries where life is really tough. You really do get a feeling for where the people live and what they go through, and sort of the humor and the things that I respect about humans you see in their lives more predominantly than, let's see, if you're walking along the streets of Manhattan.
Mm. Are you able to really immerse yourself in the local culture when you travel?
Sometimes I don't have much choice, but yeah, I certainly can.
Mm-hmm. And is it typically business that's taking you on your travels?
Oh, it's always business.
It's always business. Tell us a little bit about meeting Clark.
That was a fun little gag. I got a call, not a gag, but it was a fun surprise. I got a call from my client in Sri Lanka, and they called me and they asked me to come over. They were going over the review. They told me I'd arrive Sri Lanka about 2 o'clock in the morning, that we'd have a meeting that day at about 9 o'clock, and then we'd have lunch. And then I'd have the afternoon to try to get myself together. And then Saturday morning, we were having about a two-hour session at Arthur C. Clarke's house.
Wow.
I was completely stunned. They knew that I love his writing. And actually, they were quite good friends with him. He was, unfortunately, the chancellor of the university there, and he was quite a commanding figure in Sri Lanka. They loved the man, and he did quite a bit for the country. So it was quite an honor to actually wind up sitting in his library talking to Arthur C. Clarke. His legs were bothering him then, so he was in his robe and couldn't get around too well, but we had a fine old time, I promise you that.
What is the real picture you're painting? That's so interesting. So did meeting him, when was that?
I'm sorry.
When was that? What year was that?
Well, let's see. Let me get it together. I'm not real good with dates, but I would guess that was about 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So did you notice a change in how you approached your writing at all, or who you view yourself as a writer after meeting him? Did any of that change?
Well, frankly, as far as I've always been concerned, he's the father of hard science fiction, and all he did was confirm that to me when I was visiting him. A cute story, just takes a second. Once he'd qualified that I was the kind of person he wanted to talk to, which took about 10 minutes, by the way. I think I was sweating freely by then.
Were you having to prove yourself?
Yeah, I really had to prove myself to him.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we got on quite well after that, and we talked to him a few times, and actually was supposed to have lunch with him, but his legs were bothering him even more about 4 months later. But he couldn't walk, so he was sending me all over his library getting various things for me, for him. And he mentioned that the pool at the Johnson Space Flight Center at one time, I think, may still be called the Arthur C. Clarke pool, and that's because he was sitting with Wernher von Braun. Von Braun couldn't figure out any way to train astronauts to live in space or work in weightless conditions, and he simply turned to von Braun and he said, "Dig a pool," and walked off, and von Braun went crazy. So they built a 4-million-gallon pool at that time, and they named it after him, and the astronauts always cared a lot about him. So he had me get a book down. And so I figured what book it was, but in the front of the book was the Neil Armstrong and the original Apollo crew as they landed on the moon. And inside the very first page was a tiny circle with two pieces of plastic built into the page, and in the middle was a little, hardly larger than a piece of dust. And he asked me if I knew what that was, and I had no idea. He said, "That's the only moonstone outside the museum in the entire world," and that was given to him by Neil Armstrong.
Oh, wow.
Oh, he dived with, by the way, in Sri Lanka. He was very big on scuba diving and whatnot.
Wow.
I'm sorry, I don't want to get carried away with that.
No,
but I enjoyed the man very much.
Oh, that's lovely. What a story. You mentioned that he talked about hard science fiction, and I know this is kind of a genre of science fiction that you are very passionate about. So there's really a lot of books these days that are classified as science fiction that are more in the fantasy realm. So tell us what your vision of hard science fiction is.
Well, first of all, it's not fantasy, full stop.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the two genres have gotten confused. If I go up into a bookshop these days, I get goose flesh or whatever. Maybe it's an allergic reaction. I look and I see dragons and dungeons and princesses and all kinds of it's not foolishness. It's a fine literature. It's fun, well written, and it's enjoyable. But it has absolutely nothing to do with science fiction. And I don't know how they got confused.
Mm-hmm.
Infused together. I think it gives science fiction a bad name, and it's probably misleading about fantasy as well. And then, of course, within science fiction, there are other subgenres that I think also reflect on science fiction, such as the Star Trek stuff, which is beautiful stuff. Hell, I'm a Trekkie. I watch Star Trek all the time. But, again, that's wonderful stories, but it's not science fiction. There's really no science into it more than there is jargon, good acting, and good writing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is another subset of science fiction that simply frees the writer's imagination to say it's an infinite universe with infinite time, therefore infinite things can happen, and they write stories that can be astounding. Again, having nothing to do with science, but they are real science fiction, and I really respect authors that can do that. And then there's science fiction. It's really based on science, provable hard science, where you actually learn quite a bit from reading the book, and the author extrapolates that knowledge into either the future or extrapolates, superimposes it on the human condition, or both.
Mm-hmm.
In which case you really do have something, I think, of value, I think of great importance, and I think something that is slightly diminished by the other genres that claim to be science fiction.
Mm-hmm. No, this series is very much the hard science fiction. So has science been a true interest of yours throughout your life?
Oh, yes. My family, I had an uncle who worked with Elmer Oppenheimer on Oak Ridge and then later in Sandia on those sort of projects. My father at one time was called the nation's leading expert on the transportation and safety of nuclear weapons.
Wow.
Yeah, in fact, my family has always been sort of involved with science. I suppose that had a lot to do with it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you still do a lot of research in the whole realm of science for your books or for your own interest?
For the books, I do quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is the most enjoyable part. You write something, and you describe a capability or a process, and then you reverse engineer it into something that's credible,
mm-hmm.
based on real science.
Mm-hmm.
I lie in the book, and then I make it true in the book.
Oh, that's great. You must have a lot of fun writing.
Oh, I do very much.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about this series, Anno Nero, this first book.
Well, it takes place, the first book takes place predominantly on an island called Onero, which is Greek for dream, and the island doesn't even get a name until halfway through the book. With a main character called Philip Carr, who's an attorney and fairly qualified medical man as well. Excuse me. And he's offered a job to take over the island as president and chancellor of the university of the island, which he takes and discovers it's quite an extraordinary place academically, that they're doing some things that he hadn't dreamt possible anywhere else on earth, and in fact they were, which... The primary idea is that if you fuse all human beings, you might, A, come up with a hybrid human who's probably far superior to anything we have today, and you also might even come up with some capabilities that we wouldn't expect in normal humans, but again, are projectable based upon the science. Now, I know this is starting to sound a little bit like eugenics,
mm-hmm.
as you said.
Mm-hmm.
But eugenics is a selective application of genetics. It's making a decision of what to throw into a genetic pool and what to keep out of it. And I'm doing just the opposite on Onero. I'm throwing every extinct human species on the planet Earth at the end of the pool, and then I'm forcing generation after generation in just a matter of months or years, and coming up with an iteration of the human that could be, let's say, 500,000 years in the future in only a couple of years' time.
So you're taking time out of the whole equation.
Yeah, what I'm doing is escalating it. I'm forcing it. I'm putting the in the hothouse. And I figured out how to do that.
That's great. Well, what is the hard science in that?
Well, there's a thing called a blastocyst. There's a cell
mm-hmm.
that's produced by females that is able to actually hold seven objects in it that can be fused into a viable human being. Instead of creating from just two genomes, male and female, of those specific, I put all seven in there from, I transplant them from donors, and I come up with a hybrid of what I have is 21 species of human around the earth. The currently accepted number is seven, I believe, but I count 21 when I really got into it. And then you force these things to reproduce faster and faster without actually producing progeny. Instead, you're actually taking these blastocysts and you're fusing them together, and from there you get a hybrid and a hybrid and a hybrid. So without ever actually producing humans, you're coming up with a genome that's considerably advanced in very, very short time. Then, at any given trigger point, you produce a human, and then you see what it looks like. And in this case, the university, Onondaga, that Philip becomes the chancellor of, is populated by these specific humans, of which there's about 1,200 generations involved.
Wow. So is this...
And from there it gets a little
changed. Yeah, I bet it does. So is this basically genetic engineering then?
Absolutely not.
No?
No, not even close.
Oh, okay.
It's simply like it's Mendelian genetics. It's simply taking the genomes and putting them all together, developing a hybrid. No recombinant DNA, none of that foolishness, just forcing the species to reproduce much faster than humans can normally do it. But there's no engineering going on whatsoever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's no engineering, there's no other, there's no other tampering with the human race other than just forcing it, iterations, and hopefully developing something that has some very unique qualities because it represents all extinct species on Earth right now.
Okay. So how would you actually describe this society on Onero?
Well, they're some of the most interesting people you'll ever meet. Uninhibited, very, very good-looking, very strong, very fast, incredibly intelligent, sort of like students in the 60s only. They don't need a shower, they don't take drugs, but they have a hell of a lot of fun.
That sounds like a great place.
Oh, yeah, they must have parties that are unbelievable.
Yeah. You know, but at the same time, it does have a eugenics feel to it and sort of a master race type of an idea.
I don't like the term master race at all.
I know, I don't either.
And eugenics, truly, that's selective genetics. It's where a human being is making a judgment call as to what comprises a human genome or what should.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm certainly not doing that. I'm just making sure that everyone comes to the party, that all races on Earth are represented equally. And then another part of the university is it tries to fuse cultures and religions and philosophies and laws and governmental forms. Even cooking, there's a thousand ways at which they try to wipe away the differences that separate human beings.
I can really see why you have several books in this series. I mean, you can really take this into a lot of different areas, this storyline.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with John Goldenberg. He is the author of Onero, and you can find out more about John through his website, john-goldenberg.com.
And actually, why it finally winds up, as all good science fiction must, it winds up off-planet.
Okay. In book four?
I'm sorry?
In book four?
No, actually it gets off planet in book two. It actually arrives somewhere in book three, and they have quite an interesting experience. And then on book four, they return to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Radically changed Earth because of what they did before they left through O'Neill, and also because of good old Einsteinian physics that time just passed a little further on Earth than it did for the guys on the ship. Not that these people are doing warp speed or any of that foolishness. They can't even go light speed. They can approach light speed a little bit, and that does create some time dilation, of course, and it does... it does get them as about 7 light years away in the course of about 56 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a lot has changed.
And they live inside of their own planet. That they actually engineered a planet inside of a volcano just about 400 miles from O'Neill, and that's the ship that actually takes off with the help of some friends that are non-human.
Okay. Wow, you have a lot of threads going on in this. How long did it take you to actually formulate this, the original idea for this book and this series?
Oh, the idea for me goes back about 4 years, I would guess.
Okay. And so how did Philip Carr, your main character, how did he come about?
Well, I was looking for someone who was not heroic, but someone who was quite attractive and quite independent, had to be, for what he was going to have to go through. His book, and quite intelligent, and good-looking, and likable. So kind of a neat guy, but sort of a loner. Actually, I do know a fellow named Philip Carr, and it's modeled after him.
Oh, it is? Does he know this?
No, I'm sure.
He doesn't? Okay. Well, how interesting. And he'll be in all four books?
Yes. I'm not going to kill him off. He's going to stick around.
That's great. I'm really interested to hear also of the whole idea of fear management and education that you throw into this book, and if there's any clinical or scientific basis in how you present it.
You know, I did speak to a psychologist. Actually, she was a psychiatrist at great length about this. I was staying here at the hotel, as a matter of fact. And we all go back to our childhood where your mother says, tell me about it, cry it out. Your girlfriend says, be sensitive. Show your emotions. Don't be afraid to communicate. In other words, don't be stoic about things and don't hold things in. And I take the complete opposite idea. Hold it in. Be stoic about it. And you'll learn from it. Learn how to take your fear. Learn how to take pain. Learn how to take grief. Learn how to take all the things that bother you. Hold them in. Learn from them. Do what I call wrap them. And that means store them away somewhere in your mind and bring it out when you need it, and it will help you then. It will not, I don't mean bring it out and suddenly break into tears. I mean bring it out when you need to use your head or when you need some courage or when you need to withstand pain, and they will help you.
That's kind of the opposite of the model that most therapists are utilizing.
Oh, absolutely it is. Although the psychiatrist told me that there is a sort of a burgeoning new school that's tending to believe, why should you be just showing your emotions on your sleeve all the time and letting it out and reviewing it and analyzing it, aside from the fact they get paid for doing that?
Yeah.
Where's necessarily the real benefit other than the fact that you sort of feel better about yourself? Now, you may feel better about yourself, but are you stronger and are you better and are you better equipped to proceed into life? I think that's a little more important than feeling better about yourself.
That's a really good point, and a lot of times it's that a release in the moment that you have emotionally that makes you feel better. But then a lot of these schools of thought say, well, if it comes up again and you have to go through the process, so you're just continually in this process.
That's right. In other words, why not vaccinate yourself against it?
Right.
And in other words, fear being one of the ones, the emotions you constantly have to face. Vaccinate yourself against fear. Hold it in, wrap it, make a pill out of it for your mind, and use it when you need to. When you've got to face something, you're already vaccinated against fear.
Great. I love that. You also, John, appear to really disparage government and its forms and laws in this in this story. Would you tell us about the basis of that and your thoughts?
Well, let's succinctly put, I don't trust anyone who wants to control me or help me.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a government, I want them to have an army, I want them to have police, I guess. I'd like to have them to do a little research, maybe a little space program, a little National Institutes of Health, the CDC. But I don't want them looking after me, and I don't want them controlling me or even controlling me for my own good. The same way I feel about religion. Any time a man wants to start controlling other men, I find their motivation highly suspect, and that's just the name of it. This is as far as it goes. I simply don't trust people who want to control other people. I got enough problem controlling myself without taking on the burdens of others, so I don't see why anybody else is any better equipped.
Mm-hmm. So are you concerned about what you're seeing on the world stage today?
Yeah, actually, it's taking quite a surprising turn to me.
Yes.
I almost whiff an agenda out here as though something really is happening sociologically and economically. Whether we get the United States becomes socialistic. The United States has been fairly socialistic for years. My goodness, going back decades, I live in very socialist countries like France, Luxembourg. There's no evil to socialism. There's no evil to communism, for that matter. There's only evil to men. So I got a bad feeling about it, but then again, I didn't like the Bushes of the world at all. I don't like anybody in government, not one single person.
Do you feel that what's happening now in the U.S., I'm not too sure how removed you are with the whole politics of the U.S. right now. Do you think we're going in a better direction?
No, I don't.
Mm-hmm. You're still concerned?
No, I'm actually more concerned. Bush may have been, at least a lot of people felt, and maybe I'm one of them, incredibly incompetent, and he certainly was alienating, but he left people generally alone. Now, that may have wound up in an economic catastrophe that we're in now, but that's one half of the equation. Yeah, the economics, I have no problem with the government trying to control that. That's one of the functions I think government should do. But he left humans alone, generally speaking. And I think the new government, I think, will be looking more at the human being, trying to help them more. And I think it was Mark Twain said, whenever I see a man heading towards me who wants to help me, I run the other way.
Yeah. So is this something, yeah, I mean, you're living overseas at this point. Is this a big issue in the community that you're living in and with friends? Is this table talk in your circle?
Bush was certainly table talk. He was just hated. Oh, my goodness. People were so sorry for me. And they looked after me tenderly when Bush was first elected. When we re-elected him, they were just thought, well, you're just stupid. They had no more sympathy for me.
But, oh, no.
Bush was constant table talk. People have a tendency, there is a lot of Obama worship going on this side of the Atlantic, too.
There is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, indeed. Mm-hmm. Indeed. Maybe more so than on the stateside. They see the United States now as maybe assuming a more benign leadership, sort of becoming a little more partners with other countries, and maybe showing a little more respect, and they're possibly right.
Mm-hmm.
Intelligently done, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not, I don't necessarily say we're doing it intelligently, but it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, it will be interesting to see where we go in the future. Are these topics of sort of present-day politics, will that pop up in any of your books?
Actually, the books, the Onero series, disregarding the history for a while, the history books and the general fiction, the Onero series will probably pretty much destroy most governments.
Hmm. How so?
Violently, terribly. It's a horrible thing. But it's really no one's fault. In book two, there's a war, a horrible war, that just destroys most of the institutions on Earth. But it's a unique war in that there are no malefactors. Everyone's good guys. Everyone's doing what they think is correct, what they really believe is correct. There's no pen-plated guys out there trying to take over the world. There's no Hitlers. There's no Stalins. There's none of that. There's people just doing their best, and it just doesn't work out well. kind of a sad state.
So with this series, you know, considering that it is hard science fiction, you are really wanting to inform and give insight to the reader. As you mentioned, you're tackling some big subjects here with the whole human gene, government, all of that. What ultimately were you hoping to sort of inform the reader, or what seeds were you hoping to plant for the reader with this series?
Actually, to me, the most enjoyable books are books where you simply are, ideas are thrown at you. You learn from them. They sort of percolate in your mind, and they're wrapped around an entertaining story. And you're learning and thinking and having fun. And that's really as far as I was going for it. I wasn't prognosticating the end of the world or the way human beings should live. Just a good story, hopefully a good fun read, where you really learn some things about science and maybe about the world, too.
That's fantastic. So who are you reading today? What books are inspiring you?
Today?
Yeah.
you know, I...
or do you have time for it?
Well, I'm reading. I do read, particularly on airplanes. I'm reading... I don't think I want to say what I'm reading.
Oh, no.
It's science fiction, but it's some of the science fiction that I've been denigrating earlier.
Oh, no. That's so funny. So
you're an embarrassing question there.
Yeah, didn't mean to embarrass you. That is really funny. So where are you at with the process? What books are you working on now? I imagine book two is already complete.
It's just about complete now, and some of it's already gone into editing. So hopefully I'll have that out first half of this year.
How can you juggle so many books at once? You don't get confused or overwhelmed?
No, actually, you know how writers will sometimes say it just sort of writes itself. Some of these do. You just sort of sit down and you wait to be entertained, and your fingers do all the work. And I just sit there and read it and think, hey, that's cool.
And enjoy the process.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, I mentioned earlier that your website is john-goldenberg.com, and tell us a little bit about what we can find there. And then also let us know about your hotel and your website for your hotel.
Oh, sure. Well, on the John Goldenberg website, there'll be some pretty pictures of me. It's just almost breathtaking. And there's excerpts from a lot of the books and the books that are done. And there's a description of works in process. There's some other extraneous things that I just think of interest that I throw on there once in a while. It's a pretty straightforward website.
Okay.
The website for the I'd love to get a plug for the hotel. The hotel is called Villa Saint-Maxime. That's and the website is villa-st-maxime, M-A-X-I-M-E.com. And we're in the hills overlooking the Bay of Angels down in the Mediterranean. Between Nice and Juanita, actually, we see directly into the Cap d'Antibes. We even see the lighthouse at La Garoupe at night, about 10 minutes from the sea. And we're in a lovely old town called Saint-Paul-de-Vence, which is about it's well over 1,000 years old, little cobblestone streets. And the turn of the last century was a ghost town, and then people like Picasso and Renoir and Matisse. In fact, almost every famous artist of the last century has squatted there one time or another and painted there because the light here is very special. It's like the light in Athens. It has sort of a gold quality to it.
Mm.
So we had a lot of interesting people at the hotel, fascinating people at the hotel, and the town itself, believe it or not, I think is the second or third most popular destination in all of France.
Isn't that amazing? So you had visited there, obviously, before you acquired the hotel?
Oh, I gave a speech here many, many years ago, and then we spotted, my wife and I, she spotted a little, they call it a pied-à-terre, it's a townhouse in the old village, and we had that for about 14 years. So we've been coming here for many, many years. Yes.
Beautiful. You enjoy being a hotel owner?
Oh, I enjoyed it a lot. It was quite a bit of fun.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, it sounds beautiful. Your book sounds really incredible, and I just want to thank you for sharing with us today and taking some time out of your busy schedule to talk with us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time, and I enjoyed it very much.
Well, great, John. I'm sure that we'll talk again. You have many, many books in the future, and I just wish you all the best and much success to you until we talk again.
Well, thank you. And if you're ever in the South France, you've got to come by Villa Saint-Maxime.
Oh, believe me, I will. That sounds incredible. Well, thank you, John. You take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, okay, bye-bye. All right, listeners, that's been John Goldenberg, and his new book, Onero, is out now. It is the first in a series. Sounds very fascinating. I hope you enjoyed our talk today with John. He is a very, very interesting author. His website is john-goldenberg.com, where you can find all sorts of information about John and his book, which I believe can be purchased through his website. If not, definitely online booksellers, or get your local bookstore to order it. So thank you again for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.